Today on Dana's Low Carb for Life, I talk to Food Network star, low carb chef George Stella. We talk about new research, look at low carb history, and more, so stick around. You are listening to Dana's Low Carb for Life. Hey gang, welcome to episode 21 of Dana's Low Carb for Life, brought to you by CarbSmart.com, your smart choice for a low-carb lifestyle. Today on Dana's Low Carb for Life, I'm going to be sharing with you a new study suggesting a low-carb diet may help prevent cancer, which is certainly very good news for us. We're going to have another low-carb history lesson. It is amazing the degree to which this stuff was known and written about long before the big low-fat craze started in the 80s. I'm going to answer a question I got recently about substituting for nut meal in baking recipes. And finally, I have an interview again. I'll be talking with my friend George Stella, low-carb chef extraordinaire, Food Network star, and a guy with one of the most amazing low-carb stories I know. Clearly, I hadn't spoken to George in way too long, because what was supposed to be a 15-minute interview ran almost an hour, so we'll divide it up between at least two, probably three, maybe four shows. We'll see. Before we get to all that, though, I want to urge you all to consider signing up for the Low Carb Cruise that's happening in May of 2012. This will be my fourth year going. It is going to be an amazing time. You'll meet me. You'll meet Jimmy Moore. You'll meet a whole lot of other cool folks. Fred Hahn, Tom Naughton. But we're going to Mary Vernon and Jackie Eberstein come. We're going for a full week. We've got a bunch of really exciting new speakers, too, that I am absolutely over the moon about. Our award-winning science writer, Gary Taubes, author of Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It, and also Good Calories, Get Bad Calories. I consider those the two most important nutrition books of the last 10 years. And I am so excited to be seeing Gary Taubes speak again. I've been lucky enough to see him speak before. Also, Denise Minger, who, if you don't know her, is a truly amazing blogger, best known for her devastating deconstruction of T. Colin Campbell's China study. Now, we'll put up a link on the show page at danaslowcarbforlife.com to take you to the Low Carb Cruise site. $25 will hold your space at our group rate, but that deal is only going to be around for about another month, and Carnival tells us that cabins on the cruise are going fast. Keep in mind, we are not the only people on this cruise, so other people are booking on this ship as well. So sign up soon. We sail May 6th, 2012. You so seriously want to be there. Moving right along, in a few minutes, I'll share some eye-opening low-carb history, and I'm going to talk about substituting for nut meal in my baking recipes. Of course, you'll also want to hear my conversation with George Stella. But first, let's get the good news about this recent research regarding carbs and cancer. The title of this study is A Low-Carbohydrate, High-Protein Diet Slows Tumor Growth and Prevents Cancer Initiation. That sounds pretty good right there. It's in a journal called Cancer Research. The author of the study, which was the study itself, was conducted by a group of scientists working in Vancouver, but the author is called named Gerald Crystal. And Dr. Crystal and the rest of the team started from the knowledge that cancer cells are more dependent on glucose than healthy cells. As every good low-carber knows, most of your cells are just fine running on free fatty acids and ketones. But cancer cells have damaged mitochondria, the little powerhouses of the cell. This keeps them from using those fuels. Dr. Crystal thought, therefore, that he would compare the effects of a low-carbohydrate diet with that of a standard Western diet on the rate of growth in tumors in mice. The two diets were designed to be what they call isocaloric. That means they have the same number of calories, thus keeping that factor out of the picture, because you don't want multiple variables. The Western diet derived 55% of its calories from carbohydrate, 23% from protein, and 22% from fat. The low-carb diet was only 15% carbohydrate, 58% protein, which is quite a lot, and 26% fat. The upshot of the whole thing is that deliberately implanted tumors consistently grew more slowly in the low-carb, high-protein mice than in the mice eating that high-carb Western diet. Unsurprisingly, the low-carb diet mice, the low-carb mice also had lower blood glucose and lower insulin. Big surprise. Maybe most exciting to me was that mice that were genetically engineered to get breast cancer, nearly half of the mice on the Western diet had cancer by the age of 1 year, while none of the low-carb, high-protein mice had cancer by 1 year. They also stated that, in the abstract, this difference was associated with weight gains in mice on the Western diet, not observed in mice on the low-carbohydrate diet. Two, only one mouse on the Western diet reached a full mousy lifespan, since they were all busily croaking of cancer. By contrast, more than half of the low-carb, high-protein mice reached or exceeded a normal lifespan. So Dr. Crystal et al. Concluded that a low-carbohydrate diet had an ability not only to restrict weight gain, and notice they said, oh, well, it restricts weight gain, but also restrict cancer development and progression. That's pretty cool, huh? Once again, we need to remember that mice aren't people, and people aren't mice. But this is encouraging. I also see it as unfortunate that Dr. Crystal assumed that a high-fat diet was tumor-promoting. The quote is, because of the reported tumor-promoting effects of high-fat and immune-stimulating effects of high-protein. That's what he said. So this low-carbohydrate was instead specifically designed to be high-protein. Personally, I am unconvinced of those reported tumor-promoting effects of a high-fat diet. I attribute it specifically to diets high in polyunsaturated vegetable oils and pro-inflammatory omega-6 fats, rather than naturally saturated fats. And I would love to see this study run again, this time with three isocaloric diets, the standard Western, the low-carb high-protein diet, and a low-carb moderate-protein high-saturated fat diet. Sadly, scientists rarely call me for my opinion on these matters, but I would love to see that. And still, this is good news for us. Again, in a little while, I'm going to be answering a question about nut meal in my baking recipes, and we're going to have that interview with George Stella, or at least the beginning of it. First, however, I'm going to do an installment of what I like to call low-carb history. It's funny how ideas for this show, or for that matter, for my writing, come to me. This one happened because I decided that after quite literally a couple of years of living with an office that was over the top, messy, cluttered, strewn with papers and books, stuff all over the floor, unbearably dusty, etc. Have I mentioned I'm pathologically disorderly? I finally took it into my head this weekend to actually do something about it. Now, I'm not finished by a long shot. My office did not get that bad in a couple of days, and it's not going to achieve order that quickly either. I am pleased to report, however, that more of the floor is now uncovered than covered. This is good news. It is a novelty that I enjoy. I also look forward to actually sitting in my armchair and reading, an experience I haven't had in quite a while since the armchair has been stacked with books and papers. Well, after emptying the armchair, I looked behind it, and I found a little paperback that I have had for years and years and years, ever since I was a baby health food freak. It's a book called Is Low Blood Sugar Making You a Nutritional Cripple? By Ruth Adams and Frank Murray. I have another book by them, too. And Is Low Blood Sugar Making You a Nutritional Cripple? Has an introduction by a fellow you may have heard of, a doctor by the name of Robert C. Atkins. This book was first published in, are you ready for this? 1970, though this is the 1975 edition, and that's the one with Dr. Atkins as the guy writing the introduction. So we're talking, a lot of this information is over 40 years old, and all of it's over 35, yet it sounds amazingly current. Much of this stuff nearly sounds startlingly new, especially to those of you who were born in the 1980s or beyond who can't remember before low-fat, high-carb mania hit. And, you know, for you, the world's always believed in a low-fat diet. So I thought I'd read to you from this little book. And first, she said, you can hear me flipping over the, open the book, I'm sure. First, I thought I'd read you the first four paragraphs of Dr. Atkins' introduction. He says, Let me start by getting one thing straight. The commonest condition I am called upon to treat in my private practice of internal medicine is low blood sugar, hypoglycemia. I know this to be true because I perform glucose tolerance tests on every new patient, and the results of this testing actually do show that the majority of my patients do not have normal curves, but instead have findings consistent with the diagnosis of low blood sugar. But more to the point, I know this because I place these patients on my own version of an anti-hypoglycemic diet with megavitamin therapy, and the majority of them improve dramatically in regard to the various presenting complaints for which they sought help. Just in case it is argued that patients who see me represent a preselected sampling because of my known interest in hypoglycemia and obesity, I can't help recalling that my own office and writing staff, who came to me as workers, not patients, has been similarly tested, and 8 out of the 12 of them demonstrated low blood sugar and a good response to a low-carbohydrate diet. And I am not alone. At a recent Las Vegas medical convention, the prevalence of this condition was under discussion, and every physician who reported doing glucose tolerance testing routinely also commented on the extreme frequency with which he found hypoglycemia. There were dissenters, to be sure, but in every case, they were doctors who did not routinely perform the test. So there you go. Dr. Atkins is setting us up by telling us that reactive hypoglycemia is very, very common. So now we have a description of some of the symptoms of hypoglycemia, and it's pretty dire, and also of the dietary treatment for the problem. They say, according to Psychodietetics, and by the way, Psychodietetics was the very first nutrition book I ever read. According to Psychodietetics, symptoms of hypoglycemia include dizziness, fainting or blackouts, headaches, fatigue or exhaustion, drowsiness, narcolepsy, which are abnormal attacks of sleepiness, muscle pains and cramps, cold hands and feet, numbness, insomnia, breakdown, inability to concentrate, excessive worry and anxiety, depression, forgetfulness, illogical fears, suicidal thoughts, tremors, cold sweats, inner trembling, uncoordination, convulsion, fast and or noticeable heartbeat, blurred vision, allergies, itching and crawling sensations, neurodermatitis, arthritic pains, gastrointestinal upsets, loss of appetite, loss of sexual drive, and impotency. Continue Psychodietetics, spells of low blood sugar give rise to other widely assorted difficulties: dry or burning mouth, ringing in the ears, shortness of breath, peculiar breath or perspiration odor, poor memory, temper tantrums, noise and light sensitivity, nausea and hot flashes. A typical hypoglycemia victim is, in fact, an emotional yo-yo strung out on a chemical reaction he cannot control, with reactions so severe